Good afternoon. My name is Deborah Freeman, and on behalf of the Rouge Pack, I'd like to welcome all of you to today's seminar. Just a short time ago when we met, Mr. LaRouche took up some profound questions, and the effect of those remarks is still reverberating in the halls of power here in Washington. At the same time, we are sitting on what is clearly a powder keg in terms of the overall mood of the population, which today is, on a certain level, tired of debate and wants to see action. I can tell you, as we come into today's event, that Congressman Conyers, who stands as the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, which is the venue where impeachment proceedings against Vice President Dick Cheney will begin, has taken the position that if three more members of the House sign on to Dennis Kucinich's impeachment resolution, that he will, in fact, begin impeachment proceedings. We just learned today that that number has now dropped to two, because Congressman Brady of Philadelphia has signed on. Up to this point, every time Lyndon LaRouche has done a presentation in Washington, D.C., within 48 hours, we have seen incredible things happen. To my mind, getting two members of Congress to sign on to this resolution, given the mood of the population and given the fact that Mr. LaRouche is about to speak, is a piece of cake. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Lyndon LaRouche.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, the time has come to make some history, to make a turning point in history, because there is no alternative. We have a military force, naval and others, stationed off the Indian Ocean region, which, contrary to all nonsense from some idiots in the U.S. community, is a preparation for Cheney to unleash war against Iran in terms of a massive air attack. You don't move B-52s into that area. You don't move four task forces into that area. You don't do the other things that are being done unless you're prepared, while Congress is away, to launch war. The consequences of launching a war are unbelievable. This would be a different form of World War III. You could not put this back in the bottle. Too many things are unstable. First of all, this occurs at a time where the world monetary financial system is actually now currently in the process of disintegrating. Nothing mysterious about this. I've talked about it for some time. It's been in progress. It's not abating. What's listed as stock values and market values in the financial markets internationally is bunk. These are purely fictitious beliefs. There's no truth to it. The fakery is enormous. There is no possibility of a non-collapse of the present financial system. None. It's finished now. The present financial system cannot continue to exist under any circumstances, under any presidency, under any leadership, or any leadership of nations. Only a fundamental and sudden change in the world monetary financial system will prevent a general, immediate, chain reaction type of collapse. At what speed, we don't know, but it will go on, and it will be unstoppable. And the longer it goes on, before coming to an end, the worse things will get. And there is no one in the present institutions of government who is competent to deal with this. The Congress, the Senate, the House of Representatives is not currently competent to deal with this. And if the Congress goes on recess and leaves Cheney free, then you might be kissing the United States and much more goodbye by September. This is the month of August. It's the anniversary of August 1914. It's the anniversary of August 1939. The condition now is worse, objectively, than on either of those two occasions. Either we can make a fundamental change in the policies of the United States government now, or you may be kissing civilization goodbye for some time to come. That's the reality. Anyone who thinks differently is either just an incompetent or an idiot or a raving lunatic. That's reality. Are you prepared to act now? If you're not prepared to act, please leave the House of Representatives. If you're not prepared to act, please leave the Senate. And above all, leave the federal government in terms of the key officials, because you'll only make a mess of things. It'll be worse with you there than if you just simply got out and left it to a minority to solve this problem. But there are two things that must be done. Let's start with the simplest thing, which is on the table now. Remember, the impeachment's in the background. But impeachment is not the issue. The impeachment is getting Cheney out. You get Cheney out now, and the situation can be made manageable. If you do not get Cheney out, you're kissing civilization goodbye. If it survives, it's no good, not to your credit. And any congressman who says he's not going to get Cheney out now should leave the premises now as a final act of decency. It's Nancy Pelosi and others. They can't get Cheney out now. If they're not determined to do it now, this month, before they leave Washington, they should quit now. Submit their resignation and let somebody who's more competent come in. Because it has to happen. Cheney has to go. The impeachment process is not the process by which we get rid of Cheney. The process by which you get rid of Cheney is a good number of gentlemen and ladies meet and tell this jerk that he's gone. Voluntarily, it'd be the best his best option. Get him out of there. Break the command structure. Isolate the idiot in the White House. He then becomes manageable. As long as Cheney's in there, he is not manageable. He has no brains, he has no intelligence, he has no judgment. He's a fool. But he was put into the presidency because people who put him there knew he was a fool. They put him under the supervision of Cheney as his babysitter. Get Cheney out. Cheney is tied to the evil. I could go more into that. But this is what has to happen. Now, the first thing we're going to have to do, we're going to have to make a decision right away to pull back the U.S. troops in the Southwest Asia. We have to pull them back into holding positions. The fundamental thing we have to do, and it won't work by itself, the holding position means you're pulling the United States troops out of the conflict into holding positions. Therefore, you are changing the position of the U.S. troops from combatants in the and the issue and the target to a factor in which a group of nations will make the decision to solve the problem. That, from a military and strategic standpoint, a diplomatic standpoint, will work. It can be done. The algebra is known. A number of specialists have presented the algebra. It will work as far as emotion is concerned. As mechanics will work. But it won't work by itself. Not because it's not a good idea, not because it's not a workable idea, because politically it's not adequate. You have to come up with something more. You have to come up with a group of nations, a group of powers, who recognize that the instability of this region is a threat to the continuation of civilization. And therefore, a remedy has to be forced through. And only when the group, a dominant group of nations, say, we agree, we are going to take the concerted power of our nations and insist that this happens, there will be no resistance. It will happen. We're going to have stabilization in this region. This means what I proposed earlier. It cannot be done unless we induce the idiot who's under adult supervision in the White House, without Cheney, to carry forth on what was started at Kennebunkport. Move in that direction. An inclination to move in that direction. Get Cheney out and go back into the Kennebunkport posture. At that point, the President of the United States, or the Office of the President of the United States, has to make an offer to Putin. And Putin will, without question, accept the offer. And that is to build a coalition immediately in the context of moving these troops, U.S. troops, away from the area of conflict, where they just all they are is targets there. They're not accomplishing anything except being targets. If you want them to be targets, keep them there. The only function they're performing right now is as targets. Get them out of the target range. All right, now if we approach Russia and Putin, Putin will accept the offer. If the United States government proposes to President Putin that the United States, Russia, China, and support of India become a sponsoring committee to build immediately a group among nations who are going to address these global problems which have to be dealt with immediately. Because smaller nations, individual nations, can't do it. You have to change the world monetary financial system immediately. And you cannot do that with a couple of small nations. You can only do that from the top. You have to pull together the might of the world, the major powers of the world, and those who will support them, and say, we're going to change immediately the world monetary system. We're going to get rid of the floating exchange rate monetary system. We're going back immediately to a fixed exchange rate system. Because if we do not go back to a fixed exchange rate system of the Franklin Roosevelt prototype, then there's no possibility of preventing a general collapse and disintegration of the world economies. It can't be done. Therefore, you have to have a power group which says, we're going to save this planet from hell. One of the things we're going to do, which is the trigger point, is to get something done in Southwest Asia, to get the U.S. troops out of the target range and pull them into a holding position where they become a factor in negotiating the peaceful reconstruction of the region. That will not work by itself unless you have a power group, which includes four powerful nations of this planet and others, who decide that that's going to work. A power group which agrees that we're going back to a fixed exchange rate system by government degree as made by governments in concert. We're going to stop the floating exchange rate system. We're going to take steps to clean up the financial mess. Most of the financial claims and the financial assets and obligations in the world today are worthless. You have play money. The stock market is a fraud. The Treasury Department is committing a fraud. Most governments are committing fraud. And the British government is the worst of them all. The British government and the British system is the worst offender that we have to deal with on this planet. They organized this war. They organized most of the evil that's done in the world today. So they will not be considered as having any veto rights in this matter. But the major powers are going to say, we're going to have to go back to a fixed exchange rate system. We're going to do it immediately by treaty agreement, by signed agreement among countries. We're going to freeze a lot of things. But we're going to make sure that things that have to be paid, things that have to go on, will go on. That production is not cut. Farming proceeds. Food is produced. Infrastructure is built. So forth. And we'll have to build our way out of this process by steps, which begin with these measures. And the measure is a matter of the will of a powerful group of nations, not just the four, but a powerful group of nations which agree that this has to be done because hell on earth has to be prevented. And that's the only way it's going to happen. And therefore, to do this, we must remove Cheney. Anyone who is not prepared to remove Cheney should immediately leave any official position in the U.S. government, right now. And they should be told to leave. They should be impeached, hounded out of office, or whatever is necessary. Get them out of there. They're an impediment. Because we're going to return this government in particular to its people. And you see what's happened with the contempt which the leaders of the Congress have shown toward the people. The contempt they've shown toward the majority of elected representatives in the Congress. Toward the majority of people out there who are the constituents. What right do they have to say they represent the people when they're against the people? The people want us out of Southwest Asia. And anyone who's not prepared to do that is not going to have a hearing with the great majority of the American people. More than 3/4 of the Democrats insist on this. More than half of the Republicans insist on this. Others will insist and join it en masse if they think it has a coon's chance of surviving. That's what they want. When you say you're going to get us out of that mess in Southwest Asia, as even the New York Times said today in the editorial column, when the American people hear that we are determined to actually get out of that mess in Southwest Asia, then, and only then, will the American people respond with confidence to their government. If you don't do that, you're worth nothing. You should get out of office. You're an impediment. You're an embarrassment. For the sake of your descendants, get out of office. Don't disgrace them any further. They got enough trouble. They got enough trouble with the debt you've left them with, on top of everything else. So that's the general outline of the situation. So you have to, on the one hand, if you don't take the drastic action, get out now. Nobody's going to listen to you. You're a fool. Shut your mouth. Don't want to hear what. Don't bother us with your babble anymore. Secondly, that's not going to work by itself. But that opens the door for something else. It opens the door for going for the President of the United States under adult supervision, without Cheney, going to Putin and saying, we need this. I guarantee you that reading the situation in Russia, Putin will say yes. The United States will say to China, and Putin will say to China, we want you in on it. Yes. China will say yes, because China has a number of problems which I understand very well. And they will say yes. You speak the right way. In terms of India, India will be somewhat reluctant because it was too long under British influence. And they have to get rid of some of that problem. But nonetheless, India is seeing what's happening with the Pakistan destabilization. And Indian leaders who understand what that means are going to say, yes, we too have a problem. We're being used as a cat's paw in respect to Iran. The Pakistan situation is a cat's paw in respect to Iran. It's a cat's paw on those who are determined to destroy India too. And Indian patriots don't like the United States, particularly with the current treaty proposals being shoved down their throat. India will go along with an Indian way. It's not the same thing as China. China is simple. China says they're going to do it, they're going to do it. All right, now four powers on this planet agree that we're going to sponsor this type of approach to getting out of the mess which has been created in the world today and say the British have to be put under adult supervision. Then we can begin to do certain things. Now the big problem we have to deal with, as I mentioned before, is the economic financial monetary crisis. The United States is disintegrating. If a depression occurs, the United States will see conditions you won't believe. Nothing in the past century, no depression, was comparable to what will hit the United States if this system collapses now. We don't have industry. We have destroyed our agriculture. We've destroyed our health care system. We've destroyed almost everything that we depended upon. And if we lose the power of money, which we're about to lose, as long as the U.S. dollar was around, and as long as world affairs were denominated in U.S. dollar exchanges, we had a certain strength in this world. Not because we were worth anything. We weren't worth anything. We threw that away a long time ago. But we were worth something because the U.S. dollar was, in effect, a reserve currency of the world. Why? Because the U.S., the currency of China depended upon the value of the U.S. dollar. The currency of many countries depended upon the value of the U.S. dollar. The debts were denominated in dollars. And as long as we were respectable, people would respect us and treat us nicely because they were afraid of the collapse of the U.S. dollar. Once the U.S. dollar is collapsing, we ain't nothing no more. Right now. Therefore, we have to put the U.S. dollar under a fixed exchange rate system again. And we have to start to rebuild what we've destroyed. We have to take what was being shut down, the auto industry, put these hedge funds out of business, foreclose them, they're all swindlers anyway. Start to rebuild the infrastructure capacity, the high-tech infrastructure capacity, which existed in Michigan, in Ohio, in Indiana, in other places that we've destroyed. Build up our infrastructure, our mass transportation systems. Restore the growth of our agriculture. Go back to a high-tech economy again. Not a baby boomer economy. Not a synthetic diaper economy. And therefore, if we do not mobilize to go away from what has happened to us since 1968, to get away from the 68er mentality, to get away from zero growth, to get away from post-industrial society, to go back to high tech, to proliferate nuclear power. We need it. I mean, the future of humanity is nuclear power. You want fresh water? You need nuclear power. We're just about to unleash a prototype of a nuclear plant which is specifically designed to also make not only fresh water for us, but to make fuels, hydrogen-based fuels, made synthetically from water. And the world is going to go to 800 to 1,000 megawatt power units, which are of a new type, a fourth generation type, which are efficient for producing fuels from water, hydrogen-based fuels, whose waste product is water. Much better than coal, much better than anything else. And certainly better than using up our food supply to starve people to death so we can run automobiles. Don't function. So therefore, we're going to back to the American system. We're going back to an image of the United States as if we had remembered Franklin Roosevelt and what he did in the 1930s. What he did in the United States saving the world from Hitler. Because without us, without Franklin Roosevelt, Hitler would have won. The British would have joined him. They already had joined him. They created him, after all. So therefore, we have to go back to that image. The world needs it. Let's take the case of China. Now, China has a population of 1.4 billion people, a trillion people. And India has 1.1. Now, people think China is very wealthy. It's not true. There's some wealthy people in China. There's some industries in China which are important. But also the majority of the population of China is extremely poor. And therefore, without a revolution in technology affecting the infrastructure and so forth of the masses of China, the massive area, China has not got a future. Therefore, we have to think about that. We have India. We have probably 70% of the population of India, even though about 30% of the population of India, 1.1 people, that is in fair shape. The majority is in worse shape than ever before. They're short of water, they're short of everything. They're short of the conditions of life. They need development. All of Asia needs development. Desert areas need development. So we have to go into a period of high-tech, nuclear fission-driven growth in basic economic infrastructure. What's an example? One case, which we just had some agreement on in terms of the Bering Strait tunnel project. If we proceed, and my proposal, of course, is magnetic levitation, to build this tunnel, which connects this tip of Siberia with Alaska. Now, if we do that, and preferably if we use magnetic levitation as the mechanism, we build a line which runs throughout Europe along the route of what Mendeleev designed as the Trans-Siberian Railroad. We run a line down through Canada, through the United States, through the Isthmus of Panama, down into South America. We run the other line through the so-called Middle East, Southwest Asia, into Africa, and build trunk lines. If we do that, we can build a transportation system which has certain very interesting characteristics. First of all, it's fast. No, 200-300 miles an hour. How do you like that? That's good enough, isn't it? It's a lot cheaper than air flight, a lot more efficient, and it can carry more people and does the job. And no airport jam-ups. It's also for freight. If we can have an efficient system of moving people and freight across borders, across continents, the continent of Eurasia, the continent of the Americas, the continent of Africa. If we do that, we will have transformed this planet. If we do this with nuclear power and go on to developing thermonuclear fusion development technologies, including the management of the supply of our periodic table for the needs of humanity, we have then a prospect of a 50-year recovery program, because we're talking a lot of a lot of very long-term investment in very capital-intensive, heavy works, among other things. And these are like large river systems, water management systems, power systems, all these kinds of things are 25 to 50 years investment. Some are longer. We have to change the character of the planet in terms of fresh water supplies and things of that sort. So we have a 50-year perspective before us if we start it now properly, and we have some very good ideas about what to do. We can begin to reverse the post-industrial society, and that's what we have to do. We're suffering from an ideology of post-industrial society. Now let's go back one step on this. Why post-industrial society? Why did this disease of post-industrial society come about? We have a famous play by a great author, Aeschylus, which had three parts, a trilogy, but the middle part is the one you focus on, Prometheus Bound. You have this evil bastard, the god Zeus, Olympian Zeus, who proclaims to Prometheus, who's been taken captive, that he is going to be tortured. You can't kill him because he's immortal, but you can torture him forever. It's sort of a Guantanamo effect. And that he's going to be tortured because he committed the crime of lifting mankind above the level of animals by allowing human beings to know how to use fire to improve the human condition. That's the crime that Zeus condemned Prometheus for. We have lived in this world, for most of what we know of it, under the influence of what's called an oligarchical model. Sometimes it's called the Persian model in the times of the ancient Greeks, but it's generally known as the oligarchical model. The oligarchical model is typified in European history by the Spartan model in Greece. It's typified by the Roman Empire. It's typified by the Byzantine Empire. It's typified by the Venetian system, the alliance of Phoenician bankers with Norman chivalry, which is a form of empire. and is typified today by the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, which has pretty much run most of the world increasingly since about February of 1763, when the British defeated the French and some others and used a war in Europe to make Europe impotent, and the British East India Company, not the British monarchy, but the British East India Company, ran India as a colony with a private army as a colony, not the British monarchy, but the British East India Company. The British East India Company ran a war against China. And they did all these kinds of things. And today the British East India Company exists in the form of the BAE, which is being investigated for its connections to the what happened in 9/11. It's the one capability of this planet that could have done 9/11 and probably did. So this empire, this oligarchical system, and the oligarchy does not like a republican state. It does not like a state in which society's policy is based on raising the productive powers of humanity through science and technology and the use of that to transform the planet, to raise the standard of living, to raise the knowledge, to elevate man, but rather like something out of a nightmare of Canet, is to have peasants who are treated as cows on the estate, on the assumption that the profit of the estate, as Canet specified, and Adam Smith admired him for this, the profit of the estate is due to the magical powers of the ownership of the title to nobility. So you pay your peasants who work on the farm on the basis that you support your cows until you decide to slaughter them. Yeah? But you don't give them any more. You don't give them any credit for creating wealth. You treat them like cattle. It's the oligarchical society. Whereas somehow the magical powers of ownership bestow upon the owner the riches which are produced by society. The oligarchical model. So the historical struggle of humanity is centered around the struggle, at least in known history, the struggle for the republic, in which the commonwealth, the well-being of mankind in society as a whole, is the standard of government, the standard of policy, as opposed to government and the masses of people as an object of convenience for a few wealthy or otherwise powerful landowners or people owners. And that's the struggle. That's the meaning of the Roman Empire. That's the meaning of the Byzantine Empire. That's the meaning of the Venetian chivalry system. That's the meaning of the British Empire. And that's the meaning of every petty tyrannical regime which has ever cursed this planet. And therefore the issue is the nature of man, the nature of the human individual. Is the human individual an animal who simply has dog-like characteristics or cow-like characteristics, certain species characteristics given by a biological endowment? Or is mankind the human mind? Is mankind the creative being that Zeus hated? The individual who can create, discover universal physical principles and apply the knowledge of these principles to change the condition of life of humanity and to conquer man's problems as a whole. Is the individual sacred? Is the individual human being different than a mere animal? Do we have the kind of society which fosters that fact and bases relations within society on the basis of the knowledge that the human individual is not an animal, but has a power of reason, a power of discovering universal physical principles and artistic principles, which no animal can do, and that we desire a society, a form of society, which we call a republic or a commonwealth, in which the well-being of all of the people in society and their descendants will have a constantly improved condition of life, a constantly improved realization of the meaning of their life in the eyes of their grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and so forth to come, and of other nations too. And that's what the struggle is about. That's why what the change came with Roosevelt's death. Roosevelt represented that principle. He's the epitome of that principle. And for that reason, people like Felix Wahaton hate him. There was a meeting in the spring of 2005. As you recall, I had some success in sparking the Democratic Party and others to lead in the defense of Social Security against George W. Bush. And we had a very successful mobilization in that respect. We did save the Social Security system. But unfortunately, beginning the spring of 2005, my fellow Democrats deserted one side of the cause. They continued to defend Social Security. But we'd also raised the question, we had to defend the birthright of the nation as represented by its automobile industry, not simply for making automobiles, but for making all kinds of things, like rebuilding river systems and so forth, which that industry, because of its tool-making capacity, had provided us during World War II and so forth, and still could. We had a rotting system in the United States, and we, the members of Congress, allowed this capacity, this idle capacity of the automobile industry, which is the machine tool sector, the infrastructure building capacity, we allowed that to be dissembled and destroyed. Instead of fixing up what had happened in Katrina in Louisiana and so forth, instead of fixing our rivers, instead of fixing our transportation system, instead of restoring our health care system, we destroyed a precious part of our capabilities as a nation of taking care of our own needs. Who did it? Leadership of this came from the Democratic Party. There was a meeting at which the subject was me. The meeting was organized by Felix Rohatyn, who's a fascist. He's a guy who played a key role in putting Pinochet into power in Chile, which tells you what his character is. If you know what he did in Big Mac in New York, you know what his character is. The guy's a fascist, together with George Shultz and people of the same type. And this guy, his argument was very clear at this meeting. His argument was, we don't want a LaRouche. Why? Because LaRouche is like Franklin Roosevelt. And we don't want another Franklin Roosevelt. We have to stop another Franklin Roosevelt. So the Democratic Party, in which Felix Rohatyn considers himself a controller of, moved to sideline what I was doing. Backed off. And you saw the result. We then, the Democratic Party participated in condoning a takeover of the Supreme Court, or a near takeover, by a fascist organization called the Federalist Society. The fascist organization is built around the ideas of Carl Schmitt, the man who designed the Hitler dictatorship. Now, are they Nazis? Of course they're Nazis. Just like the Bank for International Settlement. It's a Nazi institution, too. That's how the thing was organized. So we're back at it. And Pinochet's a Nazi. Pinochet's also a part of the British organization, the BAE. He's dead now, but he's still a part of it. Now his deadness makes him a much more confirmed part of it, that tradition. Who else? George Shultz created that monster also. Others created it. Pinochet not only was Nazi in his thinking, but under his government, with the backing of Shultz and with the participation of Rohatyn, ran Operation Condor, which was a genocide operation in the southern cone of South America, which was run by a third generation of the Nazis who were imported for that reason. This is what we're dealing with. You say, why is it that Nazis are bad? Well, it's not just Nazis are bad. Nazis are a product of the belief in oligarchical society. Look back in history. What did the Roman legions do? They ran extermination operations against populations, too. That was their method. Exterminations as a method of controlling society. They ran the gladiator system, didn't they? What is that? The same thing. Now, the problem is you have a mentality which is loose, which typified by Felix Rohatyn, and Felix is treated as respectable in the Democratic Party. He may not have a swastika, no Hakenkreuz on his sleeve, But he has one in his heart. That's what he does. Look what he does. Look at Big Mac in New York. It was a swindle. Highway robbery. They looted the city. They wanted to get the human beings out of there. And you had to conceal your membership in the card of the human race and just show you were very rich and you could live in New York City. Unless you came in as slave labor or something to maintain things. But that the problem here is this ideological problem which permeates the society. We have, for example, look at the United States and look what's happened to it since 1970, 71. Look at what has happened to the lower 80% of the income brackets, family income brackets of our households, as opposed to earlier under Roosevelt, in that Roosevelt tradition. Look around the world at systems. What do you see? The objective physical conditions of life, the conditions necessary for human qualities of life, of our people, the lower 80%, has been collapsing at an accelerating rate since 1977. Collapsing consistently. There's been no prosperity in the United States. Not for the lower 80% of family income brackets. Anyone who says so is a fool or a liar. Everything is worse. Look at health care. Look at the cost of housing. Look at the quality of education. For the lower 80% of the family income brackets of the United States, everything has become consistently worse. And the means by which we had a higher standard of living was destroyed as part of the program of the Rockefeller Trilateral Commission. This policy destroyed the United States. It destroyed our agriculture, destroyed our industry, destroyed our infrastructure. It was continued under the Reagan administration. It was accelerated under the Bush 1 administration. Clinton wasn't onto it yet. He didn't understand it yet. Bill Clinton probably now does understand it, but he didn't understand it when he was president. He thought that he made the mistake of thinking that Al Gore was human. That's a big mistake. Remember the coal mine, right? 16 tons in the company store? Al Gore owned that place that got that song written about it. That's Al Gore. The guy's no good. And he comes from a background of a dad, he was no good either. Something that came out of crossbred with a possum up in the swamps of Tennessee. You know how they are. Anyway, so that's the problem is a cultural problem, is our people have come to accept the idea of an oligarchical model in society, even in these United States. We accept the injustice which is heaped upon the lower 80% of our income brackets. We accept the injustice that is done in many other ways to our own people. We sit in awe about the upper 3% of family income brackets in the United States. We kiss the butt of some millionaire who's nothing but a thief, or billionaire who's nothing but a thief. That's what we do. We have destroyed the idea of the Commonwealth. We destroyed what we prize when we build our Constitution in terms of Solon of Athens. We tore apart and disregarded every tradition, noble tradition of humanity, particularly of European civilization. And that's what we've done. And we've come to accept that. We've come to accept politicians who think like that. We've come to accept laws that practice that. We look at other nations in that way. We don't think as we should, as we used to as Americans. We used to think how we came here. Like I can say some of my ancestors came here in the early 17th century into Massachusetts and related areas as colonists. People came here with the original settlements. Didn't flee from Europe in the sense of having to get escape of the place. Some people did fit that category, but that wasn't the way the colonies were built. The settlements were built by people who represented the best of European culture. But an anti-oligarchical sense of European culture. People came here because they were looking for a place in which to take the best of European civilization and move it out of Europe, where Europe was dominated by oligarchical traditions, to build a true republic based on the Commonwealth model, which had repeatedly been tried in Europe, particularly beginning in the 15th century, but had repeatedly failed because of the return of the old oligarchical forces. You still represent nobility, you know. You bow before nobility, even to this day in Germany. You bow to nobility, the black nobility in Italy, even to the most degenerate people you can imagine. The same thing goes on in France. There are more policemen than there are people. This is Europe. Europe is permeated with oligarchical culture. Look at these two Polish twin idiots in Poland. And the Polish put up with this crap. And therefore we came here, the founders came here to bring the best of European culture here, to build a nation, to be a cynosure for the nations of the world as the model republic, the way that humanity should live. This is what is built into our Constitution. This is what is built into our Declaration of Independence. These are the ideas of Leibniz and people like that. This is what Lincoln did. And we've always had a struggle in our country between the oligarchical tendencies coming in chiefly from Britain into the United States, as in New York City and so forth. But we had a republic. And in the case of Franklin Roosevelt found us in a low moment. We'd lost 30% of our standard of living, our income, in a short four-year period. And he led in rebuilding our nation, which was shattered. Not only rebuilding our nation, but moving to preserve this and extend this, to eliminate colonies and similar kinds of oppression throughout the world, to promote a world based on republics, sovereign republics, which are each dedicated to serving their own people by republican standards, and promoting republican standards of life among people of other nations, knowing that our security and our well-being and our purpose in living depended upon what we did to promote these kinds of ideas and these kinds of opportunities among other peoples, the same rights that we desired for ourselves. We have turned away from that. This happened at the end of the war. Roosevelt died. Truman, who was a little bit of a pig, came in. Yeah, he was. I was there. And I saw the curly tail myself. So figuratively speaking, of course. But he turned away. The United States joined with Churchill and other Brits in restoring colonialism. We took the Japanese troops out of the prison camps in Indochina, where they had surrendered to a force organized by the United States. Ho Chi Minh was an asset of the United States, an ally of the United States, in the freeing of Indochina from colonialism and from the Japanese. The Japanese were put into prison camps. The ever-loving British came in, armed the Japanese, and told them to get out and take over the country until the British could get the French in there to replace them. We restored colonialism in Southwest Asia. The Dutch went in and conducted a long war to suppress independence in Indonesia. This happened throughout the world, in that form and various forms. This was the Anglo-American policy, which is what Truman represented. This is what Eisenhower understood when he gave a speech at the end of his term as president. He understood what had taken over the United States. He gave it a name, military-industrial complex. But military-industrial complex was what was unleashed on the day that Franklin Roosevelt died, when Truman took over. And the thugs who had been originally, like the grandfather of the present president of the United States, who had been one of the people who put Hitler into power in Germany, this crowd took over power in the United States under Truman. And we haven't gotten rid of it since. So we have in the United States a tendency of this oligarchical tendency preferring an oligarchical society which a few of the rich, the beautiful people, they're ugly as hell. I mean, actually, you see the way they dress and the stuff they bear at parties. Oh, disgusting. Anyway, so that's what's happened to us. So therefore, there's a factor in a rottenness in our culture, which the baby boomer generation was brought into. And that's another story in itself, which I've told many times. So we've come to the point that we have a way of choosing. We can choose to do what I proposed, which from a strategic standpoint is the only sequence of major developments which would get the world out of what would otherwise be a plunge into a dark age, something comparable to the 14th century in Europe. We could do that. We could turn to our character, as Franklin Roosevelt once did earlier, under conditions of crisis. And what I'm proposing could only be done, admittedly, under conditions of crisis. Only when these guys get down on their knees and people admit that this isn't working, that this is a danger to human life, and they have no choice, no acceptable choice but to do what I say on this one, then they will choose it. They will be happier. That's the only chance for humanity. Without the United States, it can't happen. Europe couldn't do it. Asia couldn't do it. We must be the spark plug. That is our destiny. That's our legacy. Not to rule the world, but to be the spark plug by which the world comes to rule itself. We have to be the spark plug. We have to say, we're going to pull our troops back unilaterally. We're offering everybody. We're getting out. We'll take the U.S. troops, we'll move them into the part of them out of Iraq City, into the airport. We'll move them into other holding positions. We're not here to shoot, nor to be targets. Now, we created a mess for you, haven't we? Huh? Okay, good. Now, you guys, get yourselves together. We're going to bring this fighting to an end. We're going to bring this to an end. Then we turn around, knowing that won't work by itself. But then we then go to Putin, the President of the United States, who, with one redeeming feature, he seems to like Putin or something. You never know, I understand, exactly why or what goes on in that funny mind, if there is a mind at all. But this is one thing he seems to do, and we encourage that, because it's the only, not because it's very good, but it's the only virtue we can find in the guy. So he goes to Putin and says, we, the United States, need your cooperation. We've got to cooperate and get these Brits under control. Which Putin will say, that's a very good idea. And we've got to have China involved in this. Putin will say, yes, that's true. And India has to be involved. He'll say, that's good, that's good. Better balance. And then four of the most powerful nations on this planet agree that what we're doing in Iraq and pulling back is the right thing to do. But it's not sufficient, because we have a world financial crash coming down. It's fully in progress. Therefore, we have to act also together in unity to take certain emergency measures which will stabilize the situation and enable us to organize our way out of this mess. If we do that, you will find that Germany will probably be the first to desert Britain on this kind of thing. They love it, because the Germans are really getting sodomized by the British. And they really, despite appearances, they don't like it. The Italians will laugh and say, ah, and they will be happy. The French will say, But what will happen is you will find very rapidly, immediately, and if we solve this problem, we take this whole area of Southwest Asia, which is now a terrible crisis area, and we say, this thing is going to be settled. Peace is going to come here now. It'll happen. It will happen. Because one of the things that feeds the problem in this region, in particular, is the fact that it's a region of injustice. And the Saudi royal family is not an asset. I tell you, it's not an asset in this area. They have their own agenda, and people like Prince Bandar are really a menace. So, but in this area, if we get this kind of agreement, we can bring peace in the Middle East. It'd be tough, but with that combination of power, we can do it. Because we will end the injustice. We will present a plausible, clear alternative to perpetuation of the injustice. And by our initiating the measures which bring this about, we will give the United States back a position of moral leadership in the world. Now, this is going to create another problem. We have an onrushing presidential election. We couldn't produce a farce, so we had an election campaign. What I saw this week on CNN was the most disgusting piece of depravity that has ever been concocted in the name of politics. This was absolutely obscene. CNN should run around with its tail between its legs, or not somebody else's legs, but its own, for producing this piece of obscenity. Complete irrelevant to anything of importance in the United States. Who cares what the price of toadstools is? We're in a war. Our people are dying of lack of health care. All these problems, and you want to talk about this odds and ends, a diversionary thing? Okay, but you can have that debate in East Podunk. But we have a world at war, a world depression in progress, and an explosion beyond belief. And what is going to be done by the person who's running for president of the United States? What is that person going to do and represent his leadership about these problems on which the fate of mankind as a whole depends, not somebody's local opinion or special pleading? What do? You produce a clown circus, a sideshow, the most disgusting political sideshows of complete irrelevance to anything of importance to this nation or the world. You make the United States disgusting in the eyes of the world by putting on such a sideshow as that CNN setup, that clown show. And I think the candidates should all agree not to participate in such a clown show again. The candidates should all boycott such a clown show and say, we're not going to attend that clown show. We're not going to disgrace ourselves. I just sent a message to Hillary, Clinton, for example. Hillary, get anybody else who is clean. And you guys agree you're not going to participate in a clown show like that again. You just walk out. You won't be in it. And say why you won't be in it. We're not going to have the money bags behind CNN, controlling CNN, dictating the politics of the United States. The politics of the United States belong to the people. And the politics of the United States belong properly to those issues upon which the welfare of the nation as a whole depend, particularly when it comes to presidential elections. Now, there's another thing to be considered. What about the next presidential election? We're getting close to that now. This is now summer. We're going into August. If we survive the perils of August, we are getting deeply into the next presidential election. Now, that has to be prepared. This is not going to be, if successful, a simple partisan election. It's not going to be Democrats up, Republicans up or down, either way. You're going to have a different kind of government. You probably will have to have a presidential selection as a Democrat. And we have very few people qualified for that position. We're also going to have to include a composition of a significant number of Republicans in the administration, not as window dressing, not as a political package. We're going to have to craft an administration which is practically going to have to run and be elected that way of every key position of the executive branch, every key cabinet and related position. Because you need to have a team which should begin to be built now, a team to come in with a figure as the president, with a team with that president who is ready to be deployed like an army to attack the several fronts that have to be dealt with to deal with the problems of the world. You're going to have to pick a State Department, maybe not the Secretary of State, but you're going to have to pick a team. going to have to pick at every key area of government, a team. The party is going to have to do something about the selection of the leaders in the legislative branches as teams with a mission orientation and a policy which is clear, because we have to reorganize this whole planet. We have to reorganize it mostly from top down. We cannot have the kind of silly politics that you've seen in recent years. We're now in the worst crisis in modern history, the most dangerous. And this is no time for amateurs. You've got to give the country back to the people. The people have to have confidence that the government that's coming in is their government, not a government of them, but a government which is theirs, a government which represents them and their interest, a government of competence, a government of determination. You're going to have to come in with not which enemy you're going to fight abroad, not who you're going to hate, who you're going to love, who you're going to cut a deal with, who you're not going to cut a deal with. You're going to have to cut a deal with the world as a whole. To organize an international monetary financial system, which you must do, means you have to get everybody involved in it. You may have a couple of malingerers on the outside, but in the main, most of the countries have to agree. And they have to agree not on tiddlywinks, not on bits and pieces. They have to agree on principle. How is this thing going to work? What's our general plan? What are we going to do with this planet? And therefore, you have to now think about not only getting through the month of August, but coming out of the month of August with an idea of what the next government of the United States is going to be, not based on which candidate is going to win. That will happen, but that's not the point. We need a picture, an image, of what the policy of the United States should be coming out of August, and what the government of the United States should be coming out of August. What's it should be like? What's it going to do? And let's put this nonsense that we saw on CNN to one side. And anybody who wants something like CNN again, any candidate is good, we should refuse with other candidates to participate in such a debate. Refuse. We're not going into the outhouse to discuss politics. We have a respectable forum. And we're going to discuss what we want to discuss. We're going to discuss what the great issues are that face the future of humanity. That's nice. So anyway, so that's the general outline that we face. We're going to have some discussion live soon. But that's the issue. We have to see things in a holistic way, not one issue at a time. We have to see a planet in deadly crisis, in a breakdown crisis. We have to look at things which are very ugly and deal with them in summary fashion, as I've indicated. The first thing is that decision on Southwest Asia. We're getting the troops back, pulled back now. In the month of August, not September, in the month of August. That's the beginning. It won't work without getting Russia, China, and India in to support the action. Once you reach that threshold and you've got Cheney out, then we can begin to shape up what the world is going to look like for the next 50 years.
Thank you, Lynn. Let me just say a couple of things as we start the discussion period. For those of you who are listening via the internet, you can submit questions via email, and I will do my best to entertain your questions during the course of today's proceedings. For those of you who are gathered in the audience, if you have a question for Mr. LaRouche, you have one of two options. You can either write out the entirety of your question, and I will read it from the podium, or if you'd like to ask the question yourself, we do have a microphone set up. I would ask you simply to identify yourself and tell me the nature of your question, because we're trying to kind of group the questions according to subject. Pat has index cards for you where you can indicate what your question is and who you are. We have a number of questions that came in while Mr. LaRouche was speaking, and some actually that were submitted even before he began. And they are on a variety of topics. A number of questions are dealing, Lynn, with the current crisis in housing. The first one that I'd like to ask you comes from a senior member of the Democratic staff in the House of Representatives, actually from one of the most powerful committees up there. And what she asks is, she says, Mr. LaRouche, as you know, several committees on the House and Senate side, including our own, have introduced legislation to rein in the private equity and hedge funds. Regarding the proposals on carried interest and the 15% versus 35% tax payments, I did see your very cogent comment that, quote, they should pay their taxes. Even our limited effort thus far has caused quite a response from the hedge funds and from equity fund managers. Beyond what has already been proposed legislatively by the House and Senate committees, what more do you think we should do on this?
You know, banning hedge funds is like proposing to eliminate prostitution in Las Vegas. It's you're threatening the income of the, shall we say, the procurers. But that's the, we are beyond that. We are at the point we need emergency legislation to provide for non-foreclosure. Now, look, you've got two problems. First of all, the whole banking system of the United States, the major banks, are all bankrupt in one sense. And you can't have them closing their doors. So therefore, you're going to have to provide these banks with protection. Now, you have to protect them against that which essentially controls them, the hedge funds and similar funds. Therefore, you've got to protect the bank as an institution against the hedge funds and these other financial interests, which are actually larger and more powerful than they are. Because we need the banks. We don't need the hedge funds. There's not a single hedge fund or related organization that we need. As a matter of fact, if they would disappear, it would be much better. Our proposal to the hedge funds, go before we jail you. Huh? That's the attitude. But we have to protect the banking industry. And the only way you can do that is by realizing that the Federal Reserve System, because of the appendages which have been tacked to it, because of this housing swindle, which is what it is, which is run by the Federal Reserve System. It was the, remember that in 1987 we had we had the equivalent of a 1929 crash. It happened in October 1987. And you had the incoming replacement for the Federal Reserve System, the chairman, said, hold everything. He should have held his mouth. Huh? But hold everything, because I'm coming in. And he said, no, we're locking the door before you get here. But he came in with this business of various methods, which others were accomplices in flooding the market with phony dollars, with credit systems, with all kinds of things that should never have been allowed, that should have been considered illegal, immoral, and everything else. So therefore, what happened is the system had bankrupt. 1987, October 1987, the bank, a 1929-style bankruptcy occurred. I had the privilege of forecasting it on time. With my baby. They should have shut it down, as I said. But we really had to go into an emergency measures, Roosevelt-type measures then. Roosevelt-type reforms, which would have reversed the decisions made under Nixon and under Carter and afterward. They should have been reversed. We should have gone back to a fixed exchange rate system, actually back to the conditions before 1968. Just reverse all the whole legal structure. Say, look, this is bad. This is an outhouse. This is a house of prostitution. Let's get out of here before we catch a disease. And get out of it. And go back to what had worked is the Roosevelt system of the fixed exchange rate system under the Federal Reserve System with a fixed value dollar, a fixed exchange rate system on the dollar. Then we should have gone back and repealed all that garbage that went through on Carter, the Trilateral Commission stuff, and gone back to what was there beforehand as a protectionist economy, which is the only kind that works. A fair trade economy is the only type that works, especially one that protects infrastructure. We were destroying our infrastructure. We were going to cheap shots, gambling, as opposed to actually producing. We shut down agriculture. We bankrupted the farmers. We began to shut down the Savings and Loan Association in a swindle. Volcker organized a swindle. And the entire Savings and Loan Association, which had been the bulwark of the housing rebuilding in the post-war period, was shut down with a swindle. We allowed usury. Our banks in the United States had anti-usury laws. We shut them down. We shut down the anti-usury laws. We unleashed usury. We turned the thing over to the loan sharks and so forth. So this was the problem. This is still the problem today. Now, here we are. We come to the point, what is the law of the United States? What's our law? What is the issue of the Declaration of Independence? What is the concept, the principle of law at the center of the Constitution? It's in the preamble. And the preamble says the same thing, which was the intention stated in the Declaration of Independence, on the pursuit of happiness. And what is in the preamble of the Federal Constitution is the same thing spelled out in different words than what Leibniz's argument for the pursuit of happiness as the fundamental law of government. Therefore, we should have gone back to it. And we have to go back to it today. So therefore, under our moral law, which is our Constitution, as interpreted from the standpoint of the preamble and the implications of the Declaration of Independence, that's our law, not British law. We are not a monetary system. We are a credit system. We do not allow our government to be controlled by money. We control money. We utter currency under the constitutional provisions. It is a credit system. Our money is credit, backed by the U.S. government, the federal government. We authorize, through the Congress, we authorize the utterance of a currency. The authorization for utterance of a currency, or similar actions by the Congress, especially in the House of Representatives, empowers the federal government, through the Treasury, to utter credit, to print money, and to otherwise utter credit. Particularly, we put the emphasis, wherever possible, on giving credit to the states or to the federal government for large-scale works, infrastructure, or other programs which are capitalized programs. We engage the private banking system together with the federal banking system. We engage them in the creation and management of a massive credit which is supposed to be steered primarily into improvements, which are of two types. Public improvements at the federal level or the state levels or local levels as subsidiary consideration, or for large-scale private projects which we provide credit for, as we did with the War Production Acts during World War II. We provide the credit. We encourage entrepreneurs to proceed with things that are in the national interest, and we give them preferential treatment. And we manage the system so that it is not inflationary. We also allow laws, things which are more valuable to the United States, to be taxed less than things which are wasteful. For example, if a producer, an employer, a corporation, reinvests capital in improving the firm, he's going to be taxed less for his profit than if he takes it out and disperses it. If he disperses it as profits to his stockholders and so forth, he gets taxed more. if he retains retained earnings to improve his firm or to assist through his bank in assisting other firms, he's taxed less with an investment tax credit type of program. That's how we did things. That's how we did war production. That's how we turned the nation from a junk heap into the most powerful machine the world had ever seen during the course of the 1940s under Roosevelt. So therefore, our law is that. Our law is the general welfare of the nation and welfare of the people and justice for the people is our financial law. Somebody comes in and says, like the British system, well, I'm sorry, but the money has to be primary. That's a monetary system. Money becomes the law. Under the American system, money is controlled by the law. Under the British system, money controls the law. Under the American system, the law controls money. And the law is the moral law. The moral law as specified by the preamble of the Constitution. Any act, any amendment of the Constitution which defies the preamble of the Constitution is inherently unconstitutional and must be nullified. Okay? So therefore, that's what we have to do. We're in such a situation. You can never collect and foreclose. You never collect on the mortgage obligations which are outstanding in the mortgages which are collapsing now. The collapse of these values by as much as 20% essentially bankrupts most of the entire mortgage system. Because the equity of the mortgagee is not nil. They don't own anything. They're negative equity. So therefore, do we want them evicted? Let's take the case of Loudoun County. Loudoun County was an insane county. I know, I live there. And I saw it close range. 1983, they were going what they called development by the melons and people, other fruitcakes. But anyway, I said, this is crazy. It was an area which was farming, largely farming. The ground is no good for anything else except really cattle growing and a few things like that. It's no utility for anything else. And it was being used that way, which was sensible. It needed a mass transit system in there. You know, we build up, as you can see, if you look around this area, you see we have this great agglomeration of housing all around greater Washington, D.C. It's insane. You have great residential areas with no agriculture, with no production. That is, no physical production, or very little. You have people coming from West Virginia driving along the highways in similar locations, driving all the highways every day to get to work in the area around Washington, D.C. We build up large highway systems to accommodate this, and they're still jammed. Obviously, they're nuts. These guys don't know how to manage anything. Totally incompetent. The way you manage land use is you have decentralized land use. You have communities in which you have a distribution of places which generate wealth, that is by production, and you have people who live there, generally who are associated with those functions. You don't have migration over 60 miles. You don't have 1.5 hour to 2 hour commuting to work daily, each way. What does it take coming from West Virginia at traffic hours? And back and forth, 4 hours a day on the highway. Or longer on an unlucky day. So this is insane. Now you have no tax revenue base in the areas where people live. The only tax revenue base is housing, habitation, commuting. Now you have to pay for all this commuting cost, including highway systems and so forth, which are large to carry all this commuting. But there, now what happens? You go into a speculation, a housing speculation like Loudoun County. It collapses. Now this place is ready to collapse by 40 to 50%. Well, it's 40 to 50% of the occupation in Loudoun County is doomed. That's what you have to estimate as your immediate, fairly near-term exposure. Now, what happens when the 40% foreclosures occur, or the equivalent? What about the tax revenue base? Ha ha ha! Yes, but you've created a county government with its functions, its municipal functions, which now have a tax base below the cost of maintaining those functions because of the collapse. Idiots! Lunatics! And call themselves accountants. Fire them. They call themselves economists. Shoot them. It's insane. We have all this territory in the United States, one of the least densely populated areas of the world, in developed areas. We had vast areas of farming, vast areas of industry. We shut down, and Cleveland is dead. We shut down much of Ohio. We shut down Michigan. We shut down all this vast area, which used to have in it, under Roosevelt's time, you had plants in various areas, and you would commute 15 minutes to and from work at most in these communities. And the flow was nice. You could walk to work and back. And the community had its own tax revenue base. It had a productive base, industries and so forth in this area, and services all together. So you had a decentralized form of utilization of land area, so you didn't have to travel to California to work to get to your job in New York City. Which is the direction we've been going in if somebody didn't stop it. So therefore, we have to think about, go back to fundamentals. There are no fix-it things that are going to work. The catastrophe is beyond belief in terms of anybody's usual thinking. You have to say, we're going to have to put this thing through a drastic bankruptcy reorganization. We're going to have to freeze a lot of things. If someone's living in a house, they're living in an area, they're not going to be evicted. We'll convert their obligation to a rent. We'll maintain the thing. We want them to stay there until we can find, in a natural way, a better option for them. We're going to recognize that we made a terrible mistake in our land use programs since the 1970s. Our tax programs, everything has been insane. Since Nixon, everything has been nuts. And we're going to have to eat it. And we're going to have to go back to a high-tech industry. See, the need of the world is typified by Asia and Africa. The need of the world is you've got areas where people cannot feed themselves, like Asia. The population of 70% of the population of India is in terrible condition. Most of the population in China is in terrible condition. This is the typical condition of Asia. You should look at what the income is in Africa. You should look at what the income levels are of the typical person in the so-called Southwest Asia. It's horrible. We're going to have to transform the planet. We're going to have to change the character. We're going to have to change water supply availability. We're going to have to develop power systems. We have to transform this planet into a productive planet. And areas like Africa and Asia generally are the two areas which are the most brutally afflicted. And we're going to have to save and change our policy. We're going to make North America. Again, it's going to be the fulcrum of high technology production, capital goods production, high technology. We're going to produce high technology for the world, these nations. We're going to build a rail system in Africa. They can't afford it, we'll build it for them, we'll give it to them. Because they can't develop without it. And we're going to have a 50-year cycle and figure this out on a 50-year basis. We're going to give ourselves 50 years to work it out. In the meantime, what we're going to have to do in response to the question as such, in that context, we're going to have to look at emergency measures to freeze things to prevent catastrophes from occurring. We're going to buy time. We're not going to meet schedule obligations, financial obligations, because they can't be met. So in lieu of having a general bankruptcy which shuts down the economy, we're going to defend the economy by reorganizing, that is, going through a kind of bankruptcy reorganization of these kinds of things. I say we're going to write down your mortgage. Mortgage is too big. You've got a $500,000 mortgage. We're going to write it down to $200,000, and so forth. Things like that. write-offs, because we've got to think about the future of humanity. And my estimate, and I'm a pretty good economist, probably the best you can find on this stuff, we need 50 years to put this planet back into shape. We need 50 years. We need a 50-year margin of reorganization until things would come back into some kind of automatic balance. Any other view is insane. It doesn't recognize the reality. And the thing is coming down. So what we need is the more drastic action. I mean, the things that the question was asked, yeah, sure. Normal times, that's where you look at it. But we're not in normal times. We're in an impossible situation. But I love impossible situations because they're wonderful challenges.
Normally, I take all of the questions from DC institutions first. I'm going to do it a little bit differently today because we have a lot of questions from the audience. We have questions coming in from gatherings around the world. And we also have questions coming in from labor leaders and legislators around the United States. So what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to rotate. The question that I asked Lynn just now was from someone in Washington. I'm going to try to take a question from each sector that I just mentioned as much as possible. I'd like to mention before I read this question that, as is always the case, there are a number of organized gatherings around the world that are auditing or watching this webcast, and I certainly would like to extend our welcome to them. We have three groups at various universities in Bolivia, at the UniFrance in La Paz, Bolivia, at the university in the city of El Alto, at Universidad San Simón in Cochabamba. We also have audiences connected to Lynn's webcast in Ecuador, in Costa Rica, in El Salvador, Venezuela, and Guatemala, and we certainly welcome all of them to today's proceedings. We also have a gathering of the Zimbabwe LIM currently monitoring this webcast. And I want to especially welcome them. They are our flagship youth organization on the continent of Africa. And Richmond there has a question for you, Lynn, which I'll read to you. And hopefully one of these days Richmond can ask the question himself. But what Richmond asks is, he says, Zimbabwe has been isolated for the last decade as a result of the land reform program. Illegal sanctions have been imposed, and the country has a huge foreign and domestic debt. The U.S., under Roosevelt, created the best industry from almost a similar situation. How best can Zimbabwe recover and, in fact, become the breadbasket for all of Africa?
Well, in point of fact, as anyone in Zimbabwe knows, it means you have to repeal the British United Kingdom. Because Zimbabwe was, as some people should know, was formerly known as Northern Rhodesia. And that was not a good name. It was one of the last holdouts in the humanization of South Africa. But the significance of it, you had an African farmer development, which were actually Brits, largely, who had these farms, large farms. And the British farms in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, was a prime supplier for London of foodstuffs and things of that sort. So now, from the beginning of the liberation of Zimbabwe from Rhodesia, the issue was, were we going to allow the indigenous African population, who are farmers, to have access to farmlands and to the development of those farmlands for production? The idea simply is you have an African farmer as a European farmer next to him. Would the African farmer have the opportunity to rise to the same conditions of production as the European farmer, the same credit system, the same advantages. No, was the point. So the issue here with Zimbabwe was that the British set out with the complicity of a rotten U.S. government to impress the Zimbabweans historically. They tried to bankrupt the place, in short, and got other African states to collaborate with the British because the other African states were frightened. And therefore they collaborated with the British because the British kill, you know. It's what they do best. They don't know how to build, they know how to destroy. And they, so therefore, just like what you said, the flooding of southern Indian England today is a result of British stupidity and venality. I don't know which is the greater evil, but that's the point. So therefore, that's the problem. And what we need, really, the implementation of what Franklin Roosevelt intended as post-war decolonization. That, in effect, Zimbabwe, while it has independence, political independence, is not really given the right to exercise its independence, and it's on the issue of these British control of the agricultural production and other things in Zimbabwe. They're out to destroy the government and destroy the state. It's a crime against humanity. But you see, for example, in this issue of this British demand that a Russian citizen be delivered to trial in London when no adequate grounds have been presented for accusing him of a crime. And the British are threatened to make a war over this issue. The British have no respect for these things. They still think in terms, and this is the Thatcher government was like that, and the Blair government was like that, and the present government is like that. They have no respect for the rights of others. They still think, as Putin said, in colonialist or imperialist terms, in dealing with other nations. And the Zimbabwe question is a victim of British imperialism. And it is a victim of the tradition of Cecil Rhodes, in particular.
I'd like to take a question from the audience here. Professor Nozinski, why don't you come up to the microphone?
Mr. LaRouche, you told us that there are certain very important things that need to be done, or at least started, in the month of August. Impeach Cheney, pull the troops back, get Russia, India, China, together with the U.S., begin to change the currency policy throughout the world. Do you really think that with this government and with these candidates that we have for the presidency, that anything along these lines can be started in the next 30 days?
Absolutely. But it can be done. I know how to do it, and we've got some politicians in the United States who are capable of understanding that and doing it. We also have, remember, we have also the United States, we have a military. We have institutions of the federal government and people who are retired from the federal government who still function. You know, that's our system here, as you are probably quite aware, that the government goes on. Many of us are part of the government without actually being part of it. And we have in these institutions of government professional people, skilled people, experienced people who know where the chains and faucets and so forth are to do these kinds of things. Right now, for example, in case of the withdrawal, the pullback in Iraq, this has been vetted. I pushed it. It was vetted also by some people who are professionals in that area, with the military and other areas, who have passed along their endorsement of what I proposed to certain congressmen and other things like that. So we have, under conditions of emergency, under conditions of crisis, you know, as you probably know from your experience, is that in politics you come to a point of crisis which is where wills are broken. That is where the will to act or the will not to act is broken, because reality strikes hard. and someone knows that and pushes hard on reality and causes a sudden change. We are in, as I'm sure you appreciate, a time of sudden changes. What you need is leaders of the tenor to do that, the insight to do that, and people who are willing to go along and make it work. And we have, on the issue of getting the troops out of Iraq as such, we have a very good pull right now, with about 75% of the Democrats and others in general for it. We have a few cowards and corrupt people who are against it, but we have the clout to do it. My point is, if you pull the plug, which is called Cheney, and if you can flush a lot of things at that point, and you have, even with the Bush family, look at what you have. You have Henry Kissinger, of all people, in the negotiation I was involved with, without being witting to all these things that were going on around me. In when I was going into Russia and so forth and having these discussions, we also had the former president, two former presidents, George H.W. Bush and Clinton, were in Yalta on a meeting, which is in the environment of the Yeltsin funeral. Henry Kissinger was also there. And people I know on the Russian side were also negotiating with these guys. So what happened at Kennebunkport, where the president and his idiot son showed up and met Putin, this was something which had actually been brought to maturity by people, including the former President Bush and others, who realized that this had to be done. We had reached a point of no return. We had to make a change. And there was no good reason for not trying to come to an agreement with Putin, at least on some key leading issues, knowing that if we got a key leading issue through with Putin and so forth on some steps toward progress, we could go further. And under conditions of desperation, yes, we do it. You know, this is like war. Doing what I do is like launching war, isn't it? And if you look at it in those terms, you say, well, wars can be launched and won. They're also the risk of failure, isn't it? So that's the situation we're in. And I'm in a situation where we have to fight this war. We have to launch it. We have to fight it. We don't have a chance. We don't have a choice. There is no other choice. Circumstances give us no other choice. And I think it's winnable. The question is, can we find enough good men and women who in key positions who are willing to do their part to make it work? I think we can do it.
Lynn, we have a number of questions that have been submitted both from Capitol Hill and also from around the country on the question of immigration. This question has been submitted by Mark Thomas, who is from, he's the business agent for Ironworkers Local Number 3 in Pittsburgh. And he says, Lynn, the situation on immigration is getting quite horrible. We have numbers of people sending in applications to be union iron workers, and we are in the midst of negotiating contracts to employ our members. At the same time, there are large numbers of people who are either here legally or who are completely undocumented, who are waiting in line to take the jobs being offered, who are obviously not in the union. These people, who are in fact desperate, are willing to work for low wages and for very few benefits. Many of these folks have no health care. They themselves are living on a shoestring. The whole system is unfair to them, and they are being treated as virtual slaves. But it's equally unfair to skilled union employees who also need to support their families. Can you describe what would be a sound immigration policy for the nation?
We don't start with immigration, because that's not the place to start. Let's talk about a national minimum wage law. And let's talk about, at the same time, let's talk about talking to Mexico about building industries in northern Mexico. We've already got the problem. We cursed it because we wanted it. We wanted cheap labor. Now, the point is, the Mexican is desperate, and he goes to some gangster who's a drug runner and a military skill guy who kills, and he's desperate. He has nothing. So he slips across the border. A lot of this stuff involves not only gangsters, but drug dealers and so forth. These guys are slipping across the border because they have no chance in Mexico, particularly in northern Mexico. No chance at all. And the jobs are offered here. They're brought into the United States. They don't break into the United States. They're brought in. By whom? By gangsters. And the United States doesn't dare touch some of these things. For example, in northern Mexico, right on the Texas border. The United States is fully aware of what's going on there with the drug running. One of the major sources of infiltration in that part of the world. They didn't do anything about it. They never did. They want it. They want cheap labor, and they want to break the unions in the United States. So therefore, we have two policies. Number one, we're humane. We don't do anything inhumane. The first humane thing is raise the minimum wage level and enforce it. We need to do that anyway. We have people who can't afford health care. Why? Because they don't get enough income. Things like that. So raise the minimum wage. We don't need multi-billion-dollar parachutes for bloodsuckers. Why aren't we taxing the hell out of these guys? Why are we giving them exemptions? Why are we giving them these things? We can take that away. They have no right to that. That's not a right. And the other arm of thing is to cut a deal with Mexico to build the industries in Mexico, promote the industries in Mexico. We can, for example, Mexico needs everything. Mexico does not have a rail line from Mexico City to El Paso. Not on a functioning, doesn't have a functioning rail line. It doesn't have water process. Mexico has water, but it has areas for growing crops, but it's not allowed to do that. This is something the United States created, and I was there when it happened in 1982, when they crushed my friend President López Portillo of Mexico. Huh? And that's when this hell started there. They had industries. They shut them down. They looted the place. They stole the place. So, therefore, we have two things. We've got to protect American workers. Protect them. All right. What's the best way to protect them? Minimum wage. That's your first line of protection. Protect their health care systems. Protect the things that are needed. We don't allow people to work cheap in the United States. We don't allow it. Then we do what we can to deal with the problems, to upgrade people into a higher paying job, which is not going to hurt anybody who came into this country to get a higher paying job. And we also, at the same time, work with Mexico and other countries below the border to promote the industries and development in their own countries, particularly in infrastructure is a major area of immediate investment in northern Mexico because they have no infrastructure. So therefore, you can't do much there because you don't have the infrastructure to do much with. So build a couple of railroads. Build some water management systems. That will keep people employed. You've got whole states in Mexico where the remittances from people working in the United States pay for the families that live in Mexico, in those entire states. It's insane. It's inhuman. So if you take a human approach, it's a challenge, but it's not really a contradiction. Help them to stay in Mexico, which means you may have to give a few lectures to the current Mexican government, which is not a friendly government. It's not a people-friendly government. But we can encourage, however, the government of Mexico to become a people-friendly government. That can be done with the U.S. help. In the meantime, raise the minimum wage here. We have to do it anyway.
Caitlin, the next question is from a congresswoman from a major East Coast city. She says, Mr. LaRouche, I represent a district where the only hope many young men have of avoiding a life of crime, of obtaining gainful employment, and of possibly furthering their education comes by joining the military. One of those young men who did exactly that and who served this country with two tours of duty in Iraq is now facing criminal charges because he hired somebody to shoot him in the legs so he would not have to go back to Iraq. He would rather live his life as a cripple than to have to serve a third tour. You began your remarks discussing a withdrawal plan. Yet, despite massive popular sentiment against the war, despite what we are told is major disquietude among the military brass, and despite the fact that an increasing number of Republicans seem to be coming out in opposition to the war, even a very small step to end the war failed to pass the United States Senate. I'd like to know from you, number one, what you think it will actually take. And number two, I am familiar with your Southwest Asia doctrine, and I was wondering if you had amended or altered that plan from the standpoint of an actual withdrawal.
On the Southwest Asia policy, I've not really altered that in principle in any respect. It still applies. We have to engage the nations in the region in a cooperative venture. As I said, that will not work without some other things as well. But the other things won't work without that, too. In this case here, the problem is I have a problem. I'm probably quite a capable leader of our country, but I'm all too capable for the liking of some people in power. Therefore, I'm not in that position, because they don't want me in that position. I've done a few things, as some of you know, in my life in the 1970s and 1980s in particular, which terrified some people who thought I was all too powerful. And the SDI was one of these ventures, and some other things as well. And so therefore, they try to keep people like me out of government. They like cowards in government. They prefer them. And I'm afraid that you've got a streak of cowardice which is endemic. You know, if a man gets into the Senate or the House of Representatives, and you know how he's told what the rules of the game are, and the rules of the game make him impotent. You know, I've written a great deal about this business. This is an important scientific and political question as to how people are turned into impotent people. Who would not be impotent otherwise. People are not, you know, the myth is that in society, everyone is measured by their own qualities. It's bunk. Tragedy is never a matter of individuals. The exceptions to tragedy are a matter of individuals. Only exceptional individuals will break free of a tragedy. Most tragedies are caused by common opinion, by shared cultures. If you know, you often see people who, as individuals, will act quite rationally. But when the same individual is with a group, they will not act rationally. And they are operating under the influence of group dynamics. And all real classical tragedy, including those written by Shakespeare, some ancient Greek tragedies, those written by Schiller, and so forth, all great tragedies involve group dynamics. There is no tragedy which involves a hero. They're called heroes, they're not heroes. But they all submit to group dynamics. And they say, well, I would do that myself, but I can't, because I have to go along with my friends, or this or that. Therefore, I can't consider that. They come like Hamlet, you know. Hamlet, everybody, all Danes of that type, not our visiting great Danes, but the great Danes of that act, were cowards. Intrinsically cowards. Hamlet was a coward. And what kind of a coward? You have he's afraid of a ghost. He's afraid of the king. He wants to maneuver with a play. It doesn't work. Then he says, well, nothing works. Therefore, I'm just going to go throw my body on the line and get everybody killed. And the third act soliloquy. So therefore, Hamlet, all the figures in Hamlet, except Horatio, are traitors. They're all skunks. There's not a good man among them. There's not a good person in Macbeth. There's not a good person in Lear. Not a sane one in Lear. They're all nuts. There's not a good figure in Julius Caesar, except the one who's mentioned but not present, Cicero. All tragedy is based on the commonality of self-destruction, of corruption, which works as group dynamics. The individual is bound as by an electric fence of opinion and cannot act independently. And you find often in society, you find a real life situation in which an individual, as an individual, isolated from their cronies, will act as a rational person. But when they're with their group, they're skunks. And that's the problem here is that the go-along to get-along principle in the Congress is a skunk hollow principle. The individuals who are perfectly sane, intelligent people will not act in the Congress, in their capacity as members of Congress, in an intelligent and honest way. So therefore, you will find the individual general, the this, the that, the so forth, who's outside that particular part of the process. And the way you deal with that is you stir up a revolt against the consensus. Break the consensus. Destroy the consensus. That's the only way you get rationality under these kinds of conditions. Don't accept a consensus. Say, I have to go along. I have to go along with my friends. I have to go along with this. I have to go with that. You're corrupt. You're rotten. You're part of the tragedy. You're part of the. You are the problem. Because you go along to get along. You are the problem. It's breaking that when you know morality requires you to break it. The guts to do that. And I have the guts to do that. I also happen to know a few things, which helps me choose when to do that. But that's exactly it. We're in a situation where we can win. The ability to win this fight is there. The trouble is to find enough people with the guts to do it.
Okay, Lynn, the next question is from a state official. He's from the same state as the congresswoman who just asked you the question, but I'm going to ask it anyway because they have really good pizza. What he says is, he said, Lynn, today's Washington Post poll on the presidential candidates indicates that to most respondents, strength and leadership are more important to them than what was identified as new ideas. There's no question that I will work to elect the Democratic presidential nominee, whoever he or she is. But given the nature of the current crisis, particularly as you've described it, I can't honestly say that any of the announced candidates stand out, either because of their new ideas or because of the strength of their leadership. And as such, I'm not really comfortable picking a president by default. Is there a dark horse potential out there, or are we in fact doomed to mediocrity?
Well, I tell you, let me say that when I say that government must do something, I'm taking personal responsibility for getting it done. If I say that we need a president with certain qualities, and I'm prepared to do my part to ensure that the president has available the qualities they need for that part. I'm not running for office, but if we get a good selection, a workable selection, I'm going to be there, and I'm going to do my job. And it will happen. And I know some other people around government who have similar qualities, and I would ensure or attempt to ensure that they are represented. We're going to have, you know, when Roosevelt took over, Franklin Roosevelt, he brought in a guy, Harry Hopkins, who didn't come from nowhere. Harry Hopkins was a specialist who did a great deal in building up the employment, mass employment and so forth, the public works programs. But he also was a military program, because the day, as now, as what I described the situation today now, remember that Roosevelt was actually inaugurated as president within a couple of weeks after Hitler had received dictatorial powers from the original author of the Federalist Society in the United States, Carl Schmitt. And therefore, Hitler had become a dictator through Hermann Göring, who was the Dick Cheney of this time, moment, who set fire to the Reichstag in order to create a 9/11 type event, which was used to give Hitler dictatorial powers, which he never relinquished until the day he died. So that Harry Hopkins came in as Roosevelt's man because Harry Hopkins was also a key part of the military organization of the United States. And the day that Franklin Roosevelt became president, he already knew that the United States was going to fight a war against Hitler. And we had to prepare for it. And the entire organization of the effort, which included people like Dwight Eisenhower, Otto MacArthur was a key part of this, the industrial policy, other people, that the recovery program of the United States was a dual program. It was building an industrial capability for fighting and winning a war. Our soldiers were not the most capable soldiers that existed during World War II. The Germans were. Performance all the way around. The German military was far more capable than we were in combat. But we had one thing, which the United States had and created under Roosevelt, which Harry Hopkins represented. We had logistical capability. Where they had a few hundred pounds, we had tons of logistics. And we built a system. We built more airplanes than the world ever believed could have existed each year. We built more of this and more of that than anybody. And I was there. And most of our, I trained some of our soldiers. That was one of my jobs. They were bums. But we won the war. And we won the war with logistics. And that's, Roosevelt came in. And therefore he picked a team of experts among all the people around him. And that hardcore team knew that we were going to save the U.S. economy, and they knew we were going to have to fight war against Hitler. And the problem was we had to get the British who put Hitler to power to quit and join the United States. And we did. As long as Roosevelt was around to bite the hips of the, and the legs of the British, they behaved themselves somewhat. And Roosevelt used to refer to them as that bastard, that bastard, that bastard. He would tell Churchill that his key man, hey, you brought that, I know why you brought that bastard here. And so forth. So Roosevelt had no illusions. And he was an actual real leader. And you need a lead, real leader in the United States. But that's the kind of leader you need. You need the American-style leader. Not the dictator, but the American-style leader who knows what has to be done, who's determined to do it, who has a long view, who pulls the crew around them to get the job done. It'll be a mess. It'll be slop, like our war was slop. But we won. And if Roosevelt had lived, we'd have won more. And that's the way you have to approach it.
Okay, the next question will come from the audience. Michelle Rasmussen, one of the leaders of our Danish organization.
Your associates in Europe in the Schiller Institute are organizing a conference on September 15th and 16th on the subject of getting a Bering Strait connection built. And we in the Schiller Institute in Denmark have been proposing that Denmark lead Europe in building the first commercial maglev line. And these proposals have really sparked the imagination of the population and of some of the political institutions, some of the press. And the only real significant opposition so far has been people who say, well, it costs too much money. And I want to, you address some of this in your speech, but I just wanted to ask you how you respond to those people and what more can you say about the importance of the Bering Strait project to help inspire people to participate in the conference.
See, the problem with most economists, especially accountants, is they think like monkeys. And therefore, they don't know how to do these things because they think like monkeys. Now, human beings are not monkeys. Some people fool us and pretend to be quite successfully. But people are not monkeys. Now, the difference is human beings change the productive powers of mankind through the assimilation and generation of discoveries of principle and the discoveries of applications of those principles. That's the difference between a human being and a slave. A slave is not allowed to invent anything. A slave is told to do as they're told. And most people in society today in the United States are slaves. They're told not to think, and they do that very well. And they don't think. So therefore, the key thing here is economics is based on a principle which is unknown to virtually every professional economist in the United States. That principle is the human mind, the creative powers of the human mind. And those of us who are old enough to remember the time that we were actually productive, you had even in all kinds of jobs, you would have people who, you had factories that had production suggestion boxes. Now, that, they were not junk. A typical suggestion for a company that had some high technology in it would be something would have been crafted over a period of probably some months by one person or a number of persons who were employees in that plant. And they would work out a plan, a detailed plan for a device or a tactic or something. And they would work it out in great detail with essentially the equivalent of scientific precision or a machine tool-like precision. They'd work it through. And it wasn't, give a Kleenex to the something or other, but something really serious of that type, which would affect production. In World War II, in production, under those kinds of conditions, even in the post-war period, you would have this kind of re-lofting of an aircraft. For example, Grumman at one point was in the immediate post-war period was making innovations in its aircraft. And they made the mistake of having this pile-up of revisions. They would, at first, they would say, well, let's make each revision as in order. That we take revision number one, revision number two, revision number three. And the problem was that when they put these series of revisions through, they were cutting holes in all kinds of things in making these different kinds of attachments and arrangements. So they realized they had to re-loft the whole thing from the end result, rather than trying to do it step by step. And what we would have is you would have people who would make these kinds of suggestions in these kinds of industries who actually would go through that process of saying, this is the mistake we're making, here's how we have to do it. And this kind of that kind of re-lofting idea would come out of that sort of thing. So you had in the idea of high technology production, especially coming out of World War II, where we brought a lot of people into war production and similar things. We had a high premium on innovation. This continued in the so-called Cold War period, where innovation was important. And it only is the effect of the right-wing turn into suppressing the mental agility of people in production. They became less and less creative. and a smaller part of people, number of people were working. We had a convergence where the launching of the space man-moon landing, initiated by, actually, on the authority of Kennedy, was the last great step we made in net effect in this direction. And by the 1970s, we were already destroying the power of innovation in the population, and people becoming less and less creative. And what's called innovation today tends toward crap more often than it is something useful. So that's the problem. But we have the ability, if we organize properly, to stimulate this creative power in people. We're doing it in the basement out there, in the sense of getting people to go through a certain sequence of their own self-development. What's important is not getting the result which they produce for somebody else to look at. What's important is the self-development of going through this exercise of working something out more or less independently, developing their own mental powers. And that's what's important. So if we take a mission-oriented approach to management, as opposed to what's called a management approach today, a mission-oriented approach, and you give people a mission-oriented assignment with some freedom to express this mission orientation, you will find that the human factor among talented young people will cause you to generate improvements in the process, which will increase constantly the effective productive powers of labor. That what you do in planning economy, and planning programs in economy, is you play on that factor of inspiring people to become creative in a true sense, not creative in some kind of how to make a better paperclip, but really. And you get that creative factor. If you have a high science content in your drive, that sort of thing. The farmers, for example, in the 1950s, farmers in the United States had that period were coming out of the World War II experience, and you had young farmers were going to agricultural institutions, and they were becoming agricultural scientists, agronomists. And they were making innovations in crop design and in methods of production faster than the agriculture department or anybody else could keep up with them. This was killed in the 1970s, this impetus. This is the same thing in the history of war production during World War II and immediately after, the same thing I referred to before. So therefore, if you plan development properly, you plan it from the economic standpoint to activate the human factor of human creativity in this way, in productive efficiency, and this is the source of the gain, which is the net physical gain in productive output that you get by an investment. It comes from the human mind. The activation of the creative powers of the individual human mind, those innovations are the margin by which the increase in productive powers of labor is generated. And the key thing to a successful economy is to organize an economy around that kind of motivation and method. And we know that you can take a 3-5% average gain in productive powers of labor in society by simply approaching things with that kind of understanding. It's automatic. That's why we insist on that the rate of interest on loans for production should be less than 2%. Because at less than 2%, we can create a significant margin of gain in productive powers of labor, so that we can easily afford the 1-2% interest rate on the loans, if it's not compounded. So that's the way it works. And we know that works. We know how that works, at least some of us do. And therefore, when you plan how the economy should go, that's the way you do it. You look at these kinds of factors, you know how you can get the gain, and you're getting the gain by what the innovation factor you're getting from the people who are doing the job. It is the productive powers of labor, not the shrewdness of management. It's not money that earns profit. It's people that create it.
Okay, we do have time for a few more questions. The next question is from Darren Gilly, who is a UAW official from St. Louis, Missouri. And he says, Lynn, would it be possible for the big three automakers to actually negotiate a fair labor agreement with the UAW under current market conditions? Is it possible for the auto industry to overcome the unfair trade practices that are currently undermining all American industry? What do you recommend for the UAW and other unions as we approach these current labor negotiations that are now set to begin, given the current economic crisis as you've developed it?
Well, I would say the easy way to get that is let me do it. Because what it needs is you're not going to get it from the union level. That's not the way you're going to get the result. You get the result from the participation of people in the unions on the program, but you have to have a Roosevelt type of approach. It has to be the government which is able to organize its tax policy and other things simply says, we have a policy, as Roosevelt did. We have a policy. As I said earlier in response to an earlier question, raise the minimum wage. Raise it. Enforce it. Enforce the raise in the minimum wage. Then you also do other things the same way. And what you do is you consult with everybody involved on these things. You consult with unions and so forth involved. And you negotiate, sitting around a table or discussions, you sit, negotiate and say, well, would you go along with this? Would you go along with this? That sort of thing. And you come up with a package. But the intent is the intent and the commitment of government to make something work. You never will have a private initiative as on this kind of policy question, which by itself will solve a problem on a national basis. It has to be the government. The government has to have a political commitment to achieve a result and call in the people who are affected, like the unions and so forth, and say, let's discuss this. We're looking in this direction. What do you got to say about it? And you come up with a package. And with the power of government behind the package, you make sure it works. And the union understands that they cooperate, it probably will work. Usually does. If it doesn't work, you'll learn a lesson from it, and you go back and take another crack at it and do it again. Try it again. And you'll get the result. But this, it's the human initiative and human will. It's not systems. It's not plots and schemes and so forth. It's a social process always focused on one thing, a mission orientation. Where do you want to take society? Where do you want to go? How can we get there? What are the implications? And then the will and cooperation to get the job done. Just like warfare. But the emphasis always has to be on human creativity. And you will find that, in general, that the guy who is creative... See, the worst trade union bureaucrat is the hack. He doesn't want to think about creativity. He wants to think about this here deal. He wants to think about the creativity. But the young, vigorous, or the old guy who likes science, who likes this and sort of thing, he wants to do a good job. And he has ideas about how things can work, and he'll make things work. Whereas you get this bureaucratic mentality, that's tough to deal with. But you work around it. You find the creative people in the situation. You try to give them a little more leverage and make their weight felt more effectively. And it comes out. But the way to do it is simply we have to lower the profits in the United States, particularly financial profits. We have to increase the profitability of production. We have to lower the profitability of speculation to less than zero. Shrink it down. And we have to emphasize scientific and technological progress, greater in capital intensity, much more emphasis on basic economic infrastructure, it's related to production, and being intelligent. That's all there is to it. But if we decide that we're going to change the United States back to what it was before Kennedy was killed, at least... If we decide we're going to do that, and we're going to use those kinds of criteria, it'll work. It would work. Unless they kill us. But it would work. And that's how it's done. It's done by the human will and intellect. But you have to do it. You have to have it as a commitment from the top down, or it won't work. If you've got to commit from the top down to prevent it from working, it's probably not going to work.
Then the next question is from the chief of staff of a Senate office, which has major responsibility for foreign policy. And she asks, Mr. LaRouche, at the beginning of this month, coming out of the Lobster Summit, it looked as if reason had prevailed and that our planet had been granted something of a reprieve. Now, however, it looks like that reprieve was a very brief one. In your view, have we lost what was accomplished there? If not, how can we actually regain the momentum of the Kennebunkport process and, by doing so, avoid what some have referred to as the guns of August?
Well, in a sense, I don't think we lost anything as such. We lost time. We lost an opportunity, a momentary opportunity. But the problem is we didn't get rid of Cheney. That's the problem. I mean, when the president got back to Washington and he got in the hands of that roving idiot who advises him and Cheney, that are roving hands or whatever he is. But the president took us flop backwards. He was a fragile mind anyway, and the bloom wilted rather quickly. So the point was, if you take Cheney, see, the president... The fact is, the president is Trilby. He can only sing when his hypnotist has got him under control. If the hypnotist doesn't hypnotize him, he can't sing. So he's dependent upon Cheney. It's a horrible spectacle, isn't it? But anyway, so therefore, the problem was he got back and Cheney went to work on him. And the Cheney apparatus went to work on him. And he went back into Cheneyism. And my answer is, you idiots, you're talking about impeaching Bush. You idiot, you idiot, you idiot. What you have to do is get rid of Cheney. By impeaching him, well, you don't have to really impeach him. First of all, you have to decide you want to get rid of him. And you want to get rid of him without shooting him. There are ways to do that. And... you just have to have the determination. If you get the right combination of people to realize they're going to save the nation and some tough people who won't give up, Cheney is out. That's simple. If Cheney is out, this thing, Kennebunkport, is back. Provided we do what I've indicated today has to be done. You have to commit yourself absolutely. We are getting the troops pulled back in August. Not September, not November. They pull back in August. To make that possible, we have to enter into a discussion with Russia, because Europe, Western Europe, doesn't mean anything right now. There's no competence there. China and India, because India is now scared because of what happened with Pakistan. Because anyone in India who understands things know that a disruption of Pakistan of the type that's in progress now means that India is going to be affected. So therefore, this is essential. If we do that, then that puts it back on the table. In other words, you had the father of the idiot, who's not the brightest bulb in the world either, but the father of the idiot and the idiot decided that they wanted to move in a certain direction. And the father was pushing it, and other people were pushing it. That's good. All right, we've lost that in that form. But if we do this, and then get Cheney to get out, then push this at the same time, then go back to Russia, because the White House knows, whether the president fully understands it or not, that if we want to pull this off in Southwest Asia, we have to have cooperation from Russia. There's no other nation that's crucial for this otherwise. The others come in. And you can pull it together. So therefore, we have not lost the issue. That was a gain. that that happened. We've lost the way we were, thought we were going to get it by getting a first step and then going to another step and then another step of cooperation. So we lost that. But we didn't. What we did was good. It was important. We can bring it back this way. And the way to do it is go out. We know we've got to pull this deal with Southwest Asia. Pull out. Get the agreement. But we know that won't work without the presidency going to Russia, going to Putin, to get the other nations involved, to create the circumstances in which the thing will work. So I don't think we've lost anything. We lost time. And get Cheney out, it's all solved. But get him out.
Okay. This may be the last question we're able to entertain. I'm not quite sure yet. But it's a question from the audience. It's from Alan. I'm not reading this. Why don't you come to the microphone? Do you need this?
Yeah,
I mean, it's a good question.
Yes.
He's got a message from himself.
Yeah, it comes from your new paper, Music, Science, or Fantasy. There was a footnote 3, to be specific, where you go through the whole progression from Archimedes' discovery of the, well, his quadrature of a circle, and then Nicholas Akuza, his, you know, refuting of the quadrature of a circle, and then he goes through the Kepler's discovery of gravitation to the infinitesimal calculus to elliptical functions. Now, my question is, it's general, but I want to understand that progression more. Because working on the Kepler work, it's hard to really understand, you know, what Kepler's going through without really understanding the whole progression from, like, what is the actual historical context that he sits in. So I'd like to, if you could elaborate.
There's a principle involved, and the principle is the Archimedes was wrong. Huh? Archimedes was incompetent. Huh? It was competent in some things, but on this he was incompetent. Because you cannot define the circle ontologically by quadrature. You never come to an actual circular motion. It's always in some small, it's rectangular. Now, this becomes obvious to you. Nicholas Akuza was the one who recognized this. Nicholas had, in getting all these papers which he and others had collected from the archives in Greece, and where some of these old things were still there and maintained, he realized that Archimedes was wrong. And he realized that it was a systemic error in the thinking of Archimedes, which in point of fact was not an error in Archimedes' associate, a correspondent, Aristophanes. Aristophanes of Egypt made no such error. Archimedes did. Huh? Now, the thing becomes clear on reflection when you go to the first stage of Kepler's discovery of gravitation. And the point is, as long as you believe, which is what the error is of this quadrature, as long as you believe, as most people today who are miseducated believe, that if you know the mathematical formula, the formula is what determines the pathway of action. And the formula does not determine the pathway of action. The formula was an attempt to describe the pathway of action. It does not determine. It is not the motive, as Gauss dealt with this thing. It is not the motive for the action. What pushes, what causes, what is the motive? Because not only does the planet follow an elliptical orbit, but it has a certain variation in its rate of motion of the equal times equal areas, right? So what is the thing that, where does the motive come for equal times equal areas? Because it's the equal time equal area, the volume and the volume effect, which determines the rate of change of motion. So you don't have quadrature because you have a rate of change of motion, a rate of change of the vector of motion. in the smallest degree. So there is no possibility of quadrature. Now, this then involves the fundamental principle, which becomes the principle of the Leibniz calculus, which is first defined as the principle of the calculus by Kepler, on this basis and on the basis of harmonics. Which means that when you get to harmonics, you realize that, as I lay out in the paper here, the relationship between, you got this relationship. You've got on the one hand two senses that are primary, vision and hearing, harmonics. Now these are two different senses. Now you often will find, as you can hear up there at the podium, you can at the same time you have vision and hearing are going on simultaneously. Vision and hearing, which are two distinct senses, are like instrumentation of your experience of the universe. Vision and hearing, they're different. Hearing is not symmetrical with seeing. Seeing, idiots believe in something like Cartesian geometry or Euclidean geometry. But only an idiot really believes in Euclidean geometry. Because Euclidean geometry says, I believe in what I see. I pay no attention to what I hear. Typical idiot. He sits in a classroom, I see everything, he hears nothing. So it's like three monkeys, right? So in any case, so the point is that the mind is not a simple reflection of sense perception. And description of motion as described by a faculty of sense perception, whether it's harmonic or vision, is not reality. Reality is something which is neither, but is that which is common to both. Now, this faculty of the human mind to define an infinitesimal, as Kepler defines an infinitesimal, is the faculty of science, physical science, which corresponds to human creativity, which is the difference between man and a monkey. So that's the issue. So therefore, on the issue as I lay out that series is, Archimedes made an error. Archimedes was a very creative mind, but he couldn't identify creativity in geometry. Whereas Aristophanes could, his correspondent. So therefore, the once you define creativity, which is what Kepler did with that discovery, and then he went to harmonics and he defined the relationship, the Kepler's calculation for gravitation involves harmonics, not just vision. It's not just equal error is equal time. It involves harmonics. So therefore, you have the faculty of vision and the faculty of hearing, or harmonics, which is not really, harmonics is not just hearing, but harmonics. And therefore, harmonics determines the organization of the solar system. It's not quite the way you would think otherwise, but it's that. So thus, the mind is neither sight nor hearing. These are merely instrumentations, like instrumentation of any experiment. The mind resolves that which does not correspond simply to sense perception. And it's this understanding, the human mind's ability to discover these things, discover the ironies of sight and hearing in respect to a phenomenon, which is the location of the function of creativity in the human being, which distinguishes the human being from an animal. Now, once you've discovered this, then you have Leibniz's discovery of the calculus, which is based on Kepler. Then you have Fermat's proof of least action. Again, which is another irony of the same type. So now when Leibniz unifies, together with Jean Bernoulli, the question of the relationship of the harmonics and vision in this way, by taking least action as well as this principle of the infinitesimal, then you get the universal physical least action, which is the basis which leads into, once you get rid of the Euclid and all this other nonsense, it leads into Riemann. And once you get to Riemann, you have a picture of the universe as man knows it today. It's not as we will know it 100 years from now, but it's as we know it today. So the point is, once you get on that track, as I enumerate this track, the point is that this is a track which defines human creativity, which means if you just study mathematics and don't learn to sing like Bach would force you to sing, or should force you to sing, you don't know a damn thing. You have to know both. And because you have to find the resolution which makes you something more than an animal, something more than a machine. You're not simply a piece of instrumentation attached to another piece of instrumentation. You are the living mind which distinguishes you from an animal. And society and social relations should therefore be based on that which distinguishes human beings from animals. And that's the issue.
Well, when we started today's seminar, we started with the idea that we needed three more members of Congress to sign on to the Kucinich resolution in order for Chairman Conyers to proceed with impeachment proceedings. Before we actually officially convened, we needed two more. Lynn, in his first remarks, said that it was time to make history. And there are a few things that he has said that I agree with more than that. As we close the seminar, we're faced with a situation where, in order to do precisely that, we need two more members of the House. Just two. Now, by the power vested in me by Lynn's spokeswoman, I'm going to go out on a limb, despite the fact that the income has been terrible, and propose that you guys do precisely that by the end of the week. Get two more members of Congress by the close of business Friday, and then this weekend, here and in locations all over the country, Barbara will probably kill me for this, but I don't care, we will host the best barbecues you guys have ever seen. And then we can start next week, not only by making history, but by saving history. You've been a great audience. Please join me in thanking Lynn.
Are you cooking? Are you cooking?
No, sir. Lynn wants to know who's cooking. Me and Bill will cook.